Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Mayton.
Hello.
Hello, and our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we're talking to Diego Luna about Andor and reviewing that, plus Don't Worry Darling, Catherine Called Birdie, and Poitiers documentary, Sydney. But before we get onto those, what have you guys been watching? Matt, you were on a plane. How many films did you get through?
I got through four films on the way out, two on the way back. One of the films I watched is a film that is actually also out this week that's available in cinemas and on Sky Cinema, which is called After Yang, which came out quite a while ago in the US. Have you guys seen this yet?
Yeah, no. I saw it at Sundance in January.
Did you like it?
I liked the idea of it more than the end product, I think. I love everyone involved. It's Colin Farrell, it's Jodie Turner-Smith, you know, this story of a man sort of trying to discover the sort of humanity within a robot, isn't it, essentially? Mm. They have this this servant who needs an upgrade, and what that will do to him, and what we determine as friends, and what we determine as family, and whether we're sort of interacting with technology more than we are with real people. The whole idea of that I really liked, but it didn't sort of move me, did it, you? Mm. I mean, let's not pretend, you know, you've had a little wine with your dinner and you're at whatever 1,000 feet, which does affect your emotions. Mm. Did it make you weep?
No, it didn't actually, which sort of surprised me, because on paper, I just absolutely love the sound of it. I love the idea. It's directed by Koganada, who did Columbus a few years ago. On paper, I just love the idea of it. And when it began, I just absolutely loved, I love it when you get kind of like science fiction films set in sort of near future worlds where there's just kind of subtle differences, and it looks really beautiful. It's really sort of stylish. It begins with this really sort of entrancing kind of dance scene that you see where they're all playing this kind of, you know, like dance party type game. And I sort of loved that and found that really sort of hypnotic. But then, yeah, I kind of basically just kept waiting for sort of the emotional wallop that just never quite came for me, even though it was kind of, you know, I found it all perfectly nice. But yeah, I was just expecting a real kind of killer emotional blow somewhere sort of towards the end that never quite landed for me.
Mm. It sort of reminds you of AI and...
Yeah, like Swan Song, that one, the Mahershala Ali one. It looked a little bit like that.
It is, yeah, there's sort of overlap with that. I mean, that's the thing with it. It sort of reminded me of lots of other different films, which made me think that if my mind's wandering this much, then maybe I'm not as engaged as I should be.
In fairness, I'll give it another look away from a plane, because, you know, that isn't the ideal viewing experience. No. And
when it's like being interrupted by the captain's message about, like, you know, the weather in your destination, or like if you could strap in because we're about to get we're about to go into some turbulence, or like somebody comes along to take your bread roll away, or those sort of interruptions probably don't contribute to the experience. But, you know, it's scientifically proved, I believe, that sort of altitude, your emotions are more heightened, which might explain why you end up weeping like a baby at films, or laughing hysterically at comedies that then you watch again, you're like, this isn't funny. Why did I find this amusing on a plane?
Might explain why I loved Michael Bay's Ambulance at 40,000 feet as well.
Well, it's just super exciting when you're trying to eat a sort of mashed potato out of a tiny tray with a plastic fork. Matthew, what have you been watching? Not on a plane.
Lots of long form telly, like Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, House of the Dragon, which I'm getting kind of muddled up with. I keep confusing the two, but yeah. I'm enjoying both. And She-Hulk, which I'm really, really liking.
And which is better, Lord of the Rings or House of the Dragon?
I'd lean towards Lord of the Rings. I mean, I'm a big Game of Thrones fan, but yeah, there's something quite fresh and exciting about this, and it looks so cinematic as well. And I love Lenny Henry. I always love Lenny Henry, so it's great to see him.
You know, good old Lenny.
Show. Yeah.
Well, speaking of long-form telly, we should probably talk about what's out this week. It's Time to Hang with Cassian. It's this.
To steal from the Empire? To just walk in like you belong? They're so proud of themselves. So fat and satisfied. They can't imagine that someone like me would ever get inside their house. Cassian Andor, the Empire is choking us so slowly. We're starting not to notice. What I'm asking is this. Wouldn't you rather give it all to something real?
So this is Andor, the latest exploration of the Star Wars universe, the prequel to Rogue One. Before we get into that, let's hear what Cassian Andor himself, Diego Luna, had to say when we sat down with him earlier this week.
When you first played Cassian Andor in Rogue One, did you sort of have any idea that you'd be going back to the character at any point, especially after the ending of that film?
No, not at all. And it was weird because I spent, let's say, like 2 years hearing people talking about it, you know, as if I was going to be suddenly part of the saga, you know, because obviously the news came out in Mexico and it was like, well, Diego is going to do a Star Wars film. So everyone was like, wow, that's amazing. My God, but now your life is taken. You're going to have to be there forever. And da da da. And I couldn't explain, you know, I couldn't explain to people that, no, that it was just a standalone and that I was just going to be there for one film because also everyone died at the end. You know, I couldn't like tell anyone that. Not even like my family members. I was always reminded, you know, by people that this was it. You know, I was always thinking I am the only one just doing one film. You know, people normally go to Star Wars to be part of Star Wars forever, but it's not our case. In a way, it sounded like perfect. You know, it's something I could understand because it was just a film, a beginning and an end, and that was it. And I went back home at the end and I enjoyed the process a lot. And I enjoyed when the film came out and the attention, I mean, the beautiful stuff I heard about our work and everything. But I moved on, man. I moved on and I started doing my stuff. And when I got the call, I wasn't expecting it. And I was shocked and happy and very interested in the possibilities of this idea that they pitched me that sounded so cool. You know, it's like, let's go backwards and see what needs to happen in the life of someone to be willing to sacrifice everything for a cause, you know? Where does the awakening of a revolutionary happen, you know? And what is the context of that?
And so when you were making Rogue One, did you have a backstory in your head for Cassian? And does it kind of compare to this at all, or were you kind of imagining something different?
I mean, obviously it wasn't exactly this, or, you know, the specifics had nothing to do with this. I created a backstory in the world we live in, you know, also because as an actor, I do that, you know. I always look for a referent that has some connection with my life in order to trigger real feelings, you know, and memories. And so I created a backstory that is very specific that no one will get ever to know. Essentially, it's the same story that we are telling now, you know. It does talk about someone that is being forced to move, you know. Cassian being a refugee has always been in my mind, you know. It's a guy that he had to give up everything more than once, you know, before we find him, in order to survive. And that makes him a very specific character, you know, and that's where he finds the strength to leave everything behind again, you know, for what he believes in.
It's quite a long show compared to some of these series in the sense that you're kind of doing two series of 12 episodes each, kind of spanning 5 years. So were you sort of given the whole roadmap as soon as this came your way? Obviously, you've kind of only done the first season so far.
Yes, man. Yeah. It's quite interesting because I get asked a lot the question of like, how did you feel when you got to know this? How do you, you know, but to be honest, I've been part of it. I've been part of this like Tony has, obviously led by Kathy. But we've sat down and discussed what's next, you know? Sana, the producer, Tony, and myself, while we were shooting the first season, we were already talking about the second, and we sat down with Kathy, and we talked about the possibilities, the options, and Tony's idea of doing it this way is just great, you know? It allows us to do exactly what we had in mind, well, we can do it, you know, obviously, because also, I mean, we've been working 4 years in this show. We are already working on second season, but we have to get to the end soon, you know, before I'm in crutches or like before I am too old to do the stunts. We have to do it.
There's quite an unusual time split that Tony sort of talked about as well, where you kind of the first season's focuses on the year, 1 year, doesn't it? And then it's 4 years on the second series. So does that feel kind of unusual to deal with it at that kind of pace?
Yes, definitely, man. I mean, but that's not unusual. That is like, that is the challenge we have in front of us. And that's exactly why this makes sense, you know? It's because we have the time a film would never give you. There is a point on going back to this character because we'll get to see and experience the storytelling from a much more intimate perspective, you know? We will have the time we didn't have in Rogue One, you know? Therefore, if Rogue One is about an event, now our show is more about the characters and their lives and their mm-hmm. everyday choices, you know? And also, I mean, the show is called Andor, but that's quite unfair, to be honest, because this is a show about the beginning of a revolution. It's about a community, you know? It's about a community finding out they have to fight for what they believe in, and they have to fight oppression. So the story of all these people is as important as Cassian's is.
I've seen the first four episodes ahead of this, and it's quite striking just how it really has this very serious tone, and it's not really sort of quippy or sort of jokey like quite a lot of sort of blockbusters are these days. Was that part of the appeal for you?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the appeal for me was, first of all, to understand that Kathy and everyone at Lucasfilm really wanted to deliver a show that would be different, that would be different to everything else there. I think if you're going to come into such a rich universe like Star Wars is, where so much is happening and where audiences also happen to be now, it goes from my dad to my son, you know, it's that's the range, it's huge. Therefore, there's a great potential to do something different and find an audience, you know, there. First of all, so the first appeal was to hear that they wanted to do that, take another risk as they did with Rogue One and try something different. And then the voice of Tony Gilroy, you know. Tony Gilroy to me is one of the most interesting writers I've ever worked with. He's a great director, and he's a very interesting man. He collaborates in the way I like collaborating, you know. He's very open. And he delivers a very interesting and contradictory characters, you know. Characters are not good or bad, you know. It's not about that. It all exists in the great areas, and that to me is what was appealing.
What did you have to work with in terms of kind of real sets and things like that? Because it does feel sort of like very lived in and sort of gritty, a lot of this world, especially Ferrix that we sort of see.
The production designer of this show is something different, man. It's like Luke is just such a talented man, so clear of what he wants, so full of energy also, which matters, you know, because what he did is not an easy task. I mean, building all of this. Basically, remember, man, we're doing four films here. It's like no one accepts four films at the same time unless you're crazy. That's what we're doing here in this long format, because we don't approach this as if it was like a minor thing, you know. Like, we want to do the same amount of work and put the same amount of time we put into a film. And so Luke is an amazing guy that he has an answer for everything. Like, his sets, they feel lived because he thought of the use of everything, you know, and how life would be there. I remember Tony saying, this world should feel real. You should almost be pushed to forget that we are in a galaxy far, far away. As audience, you should be watching and suddenly think, feel or think that this is something that is happening in your neighborhood, that you might know these people, you know? And I think the work of the whole design, not just the production design, but the costumes and the looks, there is a lot of time put behind every look and every piece of costume. And you can tell things feel real, you know? This, you go to Ferrex and it feels like these people actually belong. And when you're shooting there, man, the place existed. It was there. It was built. It was like the street was there, the big avenue, the little alleys. You would go into a shop, into the restaurant, things would work, you know. You get into the interiors and you open a drawer and there's stuff there, you know. When you're piloting in those cockpits, like, you push a button and things light on and off. It's an amazing ride for any actor, you know, to be in a place that is giving you so much.
On that note, you've got like a great new droid to work with as well, B2. What were they like to work with?
B2 is the most amazing friend you can have, man. It's like, I mean, sometimes he's a little needy, I have to admit, but it's cute, man. It's cute. He's always there. Like, even if you don't want him to, you know, like, if you might forget about him, and when you turn, he's just right next to you. It's a beautiful piece of design, and there's a big team working behind the droids, and specifically behind B2. On set, there would be three people working to give life to this droid. And the way they do it, man, it's just, it makes you feel bad, you know? Like, every time there was a problem, it was because of me and not the droid, you know? Like, God, again, man, that's your mark, or you have to hit this, or your light comes from there, and you go like, shit, why is the droid always where he has to? And as an actor, I would say, he's so expressive, you know? He's like, so, he says so much with little moves and with the way he turns his head to you, and the voice, man. Also, that's something really important to say. The voice was there since day one. It made things so much easier, you know. The actor portraying the voice of B2 is also part of the team operating the droid. You know, I was interacting with an actor, and the scenes were happening for real.
So that's you, Matt, in the chat with Diego Luna. Shall we talk about what he's actually produced then? Tell us where we find Andor here.
So Andor, as you mentioned, it is a prequel to Rogue One, which in itself was a prequel to A New Hope. So it's a sort of prequel to a prequel. Cassian Andor was kind of a secondary character in that film. This basically is obviously giving us his sort of life story leading up to the events of Rogue One. And there's going to be two seasons of Andor, 12 episodes each, so 24 in total. And they're going to cover a span of 5 years, from 5 years prior to Rogue One, leading up to Rogue One. The first series is going to span 1 year, and then it's going to kind of speed up a bit in the second series, where we're going to cover those 4 years. Yeah, so it's basically the story of how Cassian Andor came to be, really, and how he came to be this, you know, someone willing to sort of give everything to the cause in Rogue One, really. And yeah, just the sort of story from there, really.
Is it any good? I mean, it's a very different tone. Mm. Diego Luna, I love him. I think he's great. And he brings a real sort of crotchety sort of annoyance to this role. You've also got Stellan Skarsgård in there, you know, being very serious. Forrest Whitaker, you know, this amazing cast of characters and this sort of dirty, gritty world. Is it working for you, Matthew?
I'm really enjoying it. I mean, it takes very little for any Star Wars product to win me over.
I know. I mean, I don't know why I'm asking you. You're going to love it anyway.
Yeah.
But compared to what we've seen so far of the other worlds we've explored so far, you know, tell us how this feels for you.
It's kind of moving away very much from the Skywalker saga. There's kind of little references to things, little sort of deep cut references, but it's very much, it's not focused on Jedi or Sith or the Force. It's very much on kind of the foot soldiers in this conflict on both sides, actually, on both the Rebel side and the Imperial side. It doesn't have the kind of like the fairy tale sort of ambience that George Lucas started off with. It is, I mean, I've seen it compared to like an HBO show, and I think that's quite accurate in terms of how sort of gritty and literate it is. There is like this burst of action, but it's very talky as well. It's very much sort of character driven. it's very sort of muted in its colors and its set design. I mean, there's like bricks, which, I mean, I've never seen bricks before in a Star Wars film or show. So it's very, very earthy. I mean, and the very first scene is set around a brothel. I mean, I never knew brothels existed in Star Wars. I mean, who knew? So it feels like it's going much more for an adult audience. I would say it's very much not for children. I mean, I think they'd be quite bored by it, to be honest. But it's got some great characters in it as well. I think we should mention there's Genevieve O'Reilly, who's reprising her role as Mon Mothma from Rogue One and various animated series. She's getting a chance to kind of really dig into this character. Who's obviously been around for a long time in the saga, but it feels like we're really getting to know her at last.
And Denise Goff, who's great. I love
her. Yeah, she's terrific. Yeah. Yeah, she's an Imperial. She's kind of fighting against the systemic sexism on the Empire side, which doesn't come as a surprise. But yeah, she's a really intriguing character. It'd be great to see where she goes.
It genuinely just feels really well cast across the board, doesn't it? Mm. I think just like, the acting is very good. Like the cast is very good. They've chosen people that just fit the world very well. I really liked Kyle Soller as well as Cyril, you know, who's kind of, you know, got a bee in his bonnet about Andor and is kind of after him. Yeah, I felt very similar to Matthew, really. And I kind of probably did approach it initially with sort of a bit of trepidation because of that thought that this is a spin-off to a spin-off. And do we really need to explore this character more? You know, is this just going to be, you know, filling up space, you know, on Disney Plus. The first three episodes are out now. They've kind of launched with a three episode premiere before going weekly. And we're sort of given the first four. And I'm not surprised that they dropped the first three in one go because, as Matthew said, it's very slow burn. The first couple of episodes, I enjoyed them, but it's talky and it's very much establishing the world, establishing the character, setting the mood of this series. But then in three, I then thought it really sort of got exciting there. There's this really great set piece where they're in just this sort of warehouse type location and these things start falling from the ceiling when there's this shootout, these big heavy wheels. And I just thought it was, yeah, just such a well done set piece. And then it was at that episode that the story really kind of, you know, got going, I thought. So yeah, I'm not surprised that they've given people those three to sort of get into, but I'm very intrigued to see where it goes from here and just really, really excited by it. And I feel that some people may not like the fact that it is grittier and there isn't that jokey Marvel kind of tone. There isn't quips, and I mean there's a cute droid in it, but there's not really, you know, funny supporting characters and things like that. But I personally was sort of welcomed having something a bit different and a bit grittier, and yeah, really looking forward to seeing where it goes from here.
So it does fit tonally with Rogue One then, in as much as it's really serious, apart from, you know, there was a little bit of bants with the droid in that one, but not a great deal. And it was about big issues. These people are willing to die for a cause that they feel is absolutely, you know, has to be pursued. I personally am really interested to see what has led Andor to that moment that we find him at the end of Rogue One and what drives that self-sacrifice. So I think it's something that will be interesting to unwrap over two seasons, because, you know, that is a monumental choice he makes at the end of Rogue One. And I want to know what informs that. Do you think there's enough? Is it showing you enough that we're going to have enough to go on for two seasons, Matthew? Is there enough meat there?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because certainly in episode four, the scope widens out because we see Mon Mothma. She kind of starts to play a more pivotal role because we've got to learn about her journey as well, because at the moment she's an Imperial Senator, but she will end up as the leader of the Rebel Alliance. So there's her whole journey to follow. And I imagine they will do that with a lot of the other minor characters. I mean, I think Diego Luna said it's not going to be just about Andor all the time. It is an ensemble show. So there will be enough there to kind of to pad it out, hopefully, over the two seasons.
And what about if you're not a massive Star Wars nerd? Is this something you can enjoy as somebody just who kind of enjoys the world but isn't, you know, doesn't know everything like you do?
Yeah, I think so. I think you don't need too much pre-knowledge going into it. I think that was very much the intention. I think they were trying to reach people who aren't necessarily the hardcore Star Wars fans. I think it will work for them as well.
Yeah, there's just a sort of heft to it. Like you can just sort of feel that like a great screenwriter like Tony Gilroy is behind it, I think, because there's just something to it, to the characters, the dialogue, the world, you know. And yeah, as Matthew said, because there is this sort of deep bench of supporting characters as well who are kind of interesting and well cast. I mean, if anything, I almost feel a bit like, oh, I'm almost disappointed we only get two seasons. But I mean,
yeah,
we've got a lot of episodes ahead. So I mean, I'm there's, you know, maybe that'll be enough once we've had all 24. But yeah, definitely off to a very good start, in my opinion.
Very good. Okay, so Andor, the first three eps are available on Disney Plus now, and then will be weekly every Wednesday. Shall we move on then from other planets to other worlds now? It's this.
All of you wives.
With you all the time.
We men, we ask a lot.
Can't you see?
We ask for strength.
To be.
Food at home, a house clean.
With you all the time.
And discretion above all else.
Boys and their toys. At least we know they're getting work done.
Welcome to the Victory Project.
We're all here because we believe in the mission.
What are we doing?
Changing the world.
What are we doing?
Changing the world.
That's right.
What do you think they're really doing out there?
What do you mean?
So this is Don't Worry, Darling, which has been in the news, even like not just film news, but seems to have overtaken everything with the various shenanigans of its cast at Venice Film Festival and who dislikes who. Let's get to the core of it. What is the actual film about, Matt?
Yeah, so this is a sort of film where the behind the scenes talk has threatened to overshadow the film itself. But the actual film is the second film to be directed by Olivia Wilde, who also has a supporting role here. The lead character is Alice, who's played by Florence Pugh. And she's living in this sort of happy, idealized 1950s life where she lives in this town called Victory, where they're working on this mysterious thing called the Victory Project. And basically all the husbands go off to work during the day and the wives stay at home doing this kind of stereotypical 50s stuff, basically cleaning, getting dinner and cocktails ready for later when the husbands return. And it's on the surface, this very idyllic lifestyle, very picture perfect, but very, very early on, you get the sense that all is not quite what it seems. And there's mysteries, you know, beyond the boundaries where they're allowed to go in this mysterious desert town. There's something sinister about where the guys maybe work. The wives aren't allowed to know anything about it. And there's just this feeling of unrest. And from there, Alice gets ever more disturbed as she tries to, you know, uncover the truth with, you know, within this society that sort of wants to very much keep her in her place. It is one of those mystery box films. So in terms of plot, you know, you don't really want to say too much more than that. You'll get that from the trailer. And you get the impression, you know, extremely early on, you know, this is one of those films where everything isn't quite what it seems. Obviously, part of the fun of it, part of the, you know, the point of the film is how it all unfolds.
Yeah, the hashtag on this is don't spoil it, darling. So we won't be spoiling it here. But suffice to say that if you have seen films that this sort of takes inspiration from, you're probably going to work out where it might be going. Did you say it? Would you say that's fair?
Kind of. I mean, to be honest, I didn't work out exactly where it was going, even though, you know, it's going somewhere. And broadly speaking, I thought the film was okay. Like, I didn't love it, but I didn't think it was terrible by any means. You know, it was fell into the 3-star bracket for me. But to me, it felt like a slightly overstretched episode of Black Mirror. And I say this as someone who is a big fan of Black Mirror and mention it quite often. For me, what I really like about Black Mirror is you get, you know, this one fun Twilight Zone-esque concept plays out over roughly an hour and then you're done with it and on to the next one. And so they don't have to be that substantial. And it doesn't matter if, you know, in the end, it's not super satisfying because you just then move on to the next one. But you expect something slightly more from a film, I think. And this felt a bit like insubstantial by the time it came to the end for me. And perhaps it one of those situations where it spent too long on the mystery where you know something's not quite right, but you've kind of got to go through all the motions of that discovery. And then perhaps I would have liked a little bit longer, maybe in the third act of, you know, delving into that a bit more deeply. That said, I actually thought it was a well-made film. I thought Olivia Wilde had like a good command of the tone. It sort of looked great. It was, you know, tense in places, great production values and costumes. So I thought it sort of worked well in that sense. That's why I said for me, ultimately fell into the 3-star bracket, because I didn't find it like a bad night out at the cinema, but just not a film that will be particularly memorable. And I say this as someone who, like, I absolutely loved Booksmart, Olivia Wilde's first film as a director, and obviously completely different genre, but I love that film. Whereas this film I thought was, you know, well put together, but ultimately not entirely satisfying. How did you find it, Matthew?
Yeah, similar to you. Yeah, I did, I liked it. I was never bored. It did feel a little bit on the long side. I mean, it's like just over 2 hours, which felt like it was stretching it a little bit thin. And it is quite derivative. But I thought Florence Pugh was terrific. I thought she really carried it. And I thought the supporting cast was really strong as well. Especially Chris Pine as this kind of very sinister head of this community, sort of pops in and out of the action. He clearly has some strange ulterior motives going on. And Olivia Wilde herself, I felt like she should have given herself a few more scenes, because I thought she was pretty good. And
as Bunny.
Yeah. Mm. And I thought she had the most emotional moment, which I won't spoil, obviously, but the most emotional impact in the whole film. And Gemma Chan as well.
I was going to say, you're studiously avoiding the big star in this film.
Building up to it.
The person who's not a seasoned actor, but who is going to be probably one of the biggest draws of this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Styles, how does he fare in this? We've obviously seen him in Dunkirk. He's got My Policeman coming up. This is him playing this suave, you know, sort of James Bond-esque husband, that will come in after dinner and, you know, spread you out on the dinner table and pleasure you over
me
the
out
roast
on the dinner table.
Well, his wife, and pleasure you over the potatoes. It's a role that requires someone charismatic, that you should want to be with that person. Does he manage it?
Obviously no spoilers, but there's a change of tone at one point, and I thought he was good in that section where there was a change of tone. And when it came to the more sort of dramatic moments, there's a bit of shouting. But in the more sort of casual, everyday scenes, yeah, I did find him a little bit stiff and wooden compared to Florence Pugh. I mean, most of his scenes are with her, and they do feel a bit, he's a bit overmatched, really, against her. Yeah, he's all right, I guess.
Could I actually say, I actually perhaps almost even felt a bit different to Matthew in that I felt like he was perfectly fine throughout. And for me, there was a couple of the bigger moments that didn't quite work for me. That perhaps showed up his sort of lack of experience. But I thought he was perfectly fine in the rest of it. And I thought, obviously, again, as has been talked about a lot, it was a role that was originally earmarked for Shia LaBeouf before he left the film. They're very different energies. And like, I feel like it would have felt a very different film with Shia LaBeouf in it. Mm. But I thought it worked having such a boyish, young looking guy in this role, because you feel like he's new to this town. He's new at work. I felt that sort of worked in the film's favour. And I didn't think it was like a star making turn or anything like that. But I thought he perfectly did fine. It wasn't like I wasn't taken out at the moment by, he's so wooden, or, you know, so out of place here.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of works as well, because the idea is that you're supposed to look at this life and think, why wouldn't you want this? And for many people who adore Harry Styles, you're going to go in thinking, I would love him as my husband. So his sort of outside life does feed into that character and works well on that level. I think the switch that you're talking about, Matthew, is where it didn't work for me, because it's like, it felt unconvincing. But he is a useless husband. The mashed potato scene. Can we talk about the mashed potato scene? That's ridiculous. So, you know, listeners, she wakes up and he's making dinner and he's trying to mash potatoes that are raw in a bowl with a whiskey decanter.
And she has to say to him,
you need to cook the potatoes. And I'm like, I know this is the 50s, but I cannot believe any man would not know that the potatoes need to be cooked. So that annoyed me, just on a culinary level.
Intentionally or not, that really threw me a bit, that scene. And there's a couple of things, again, I won't mention here for the sake of spoilers, a couple of other things that were sort of left a bit unresolved for me. Yes, I should also want to add as well, basically what you've already said, but I thought, yeah, Florence Pugh was amazing in this. You feel really bad for obviously both the character and her, because it's one of those films that really puts her through the ringer. Like, she's in distress and, like, really upset in the vast majority of the scenes. She just never puts a foot wrong, Florence Pugh. I literally think she will be one of the all-time greats.
Yeah.
Because she's just so good, and she's just like, in her sort of relatively brief career so far, she's just always so great, basically. And I genuinely think in, like, years to come, she'll be regarded in the same breath as, like, Meryl Streep, you know. And
she might be a Dame great, Florence, you know? Pugh.
Yeah, I just genuinely think she will be regarded among the greats. And and I agree that Chris Pine was really great as well. Like, just something really, really sinister and slippery, and just immensely charismatic about him, really, as well.
He really is.
You can tell when he just comes onto the screen, he's just, you know, you see he's a serious actor with just genuine screen presence.
The best Chris. He's the best Chris of all of them.
Ooh.
He is. I'll fight you over it. Come on.
And another thing I thought about a lot while watching this, I mentioned Black Mirror, but I thought about WandaVision quite a lot as well when watching this, especially as it coming so soon after. But that idealized sitcom lifestyle where you know something, you know, ominous is lurking around the corner. Yeah. I thought about that a lot. And there's even a supporting character who looks a bit like Catherine Hahn, which further reminded me of WandaVision.
There's a strange business with a flying vehicle as well.
Yeah. Let's talk about the themes of it as well, because it is pertinent. Mm. It's come out at a time when women's rights and, you know, their autonomy over their bodies is being questioned. And you can watch this and take all sorts of meaning from it. Do you think that's sort of an interesting aspect of it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it is sort of packaged in this very kind of appealing mainstream looking, you know, star filled movie. So it's going to start a lot of conversation. Well, it has already, but it's going to start even more conversations once people actually go and see it. I mean, there's lots of stuff we could discuss, but we can't really, I suppose, the sort of the really big issues. People will have a lot to say about it afterwards.
Olivia Wilde described it as a Trojan horse movie. That's her intention, that it's something that you go and it feels like it's a good time at the movies, but actually it is asking you to question various real life, real time themes. And I guess in that respect, it does the job.
Yeah. And quite a bold ending as well. I won't really say anymore.
I don't know. Say no more.
Yeah.
If you are really familiar with this kind of genre and this sort of film, that maybe it won't have as much of an impact for you. But I think maybe if you're someone who's drawn to the film because of Harry Styles and the young cast, etc., and you're not completely familiar with this sort of thing, that maybe you'll get more of a kick out of it, perhaps. And you're never bored. You don't feel like you've wasted your time by seeing it, I don't think. And definitely give stuff to chat about afterwards, even if part of that will be picking at a few logical holes. It's one of those films that you want to chat about afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. So are we recommending that people do go and see this despite Spitgate and the Misflow controversy? Is it worth going to pay your money at the cinema?
Yeah, I don't think you'll regret it. I think, go with cautiously. And if based on what we've said, if you feel like, yes, I know exactly what sort of films you're talking about, then maybe go with a bit more caution. You know, I think it's a solid evening's entertainment.
Okay, so that is Don't Worry, Darling, and it is in cinemas on Friday. Okay, so before we move on, it's time for alternative line reading, where we read a line of somebody's work that we've talked about already in the wrong accent or cadence. So what shall I do this in?
Harry Styles.
Shall I do it in Harry Styles' mid-Atlantic accent, which bemused me throughout this film?
Yeah. You're being hysterical, Alice.
I'd rather stop your breathing than have you doubt how I feel. That was my Styles transatlantic. When he was in Venice doing the press conference, I was fascinated by this accent. It was so all over the place. All of his A's are very American. That's all I'll say. But, you know, that happens to many people. So criticism, Harry. If you're living over there, enjoy it. But it does sound kind of weird with a Cheshire accent. But anyway, who was that?
I actually have no idea what this was.
No, I've got no idea. I'm drawing a total blank.
Right, I'm going to give you a clue. It's a Florence Pugh.
It's not a Little Women, is it?
No. Amy wouldn't say that. She is very dramatic, but she wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess, just based on themes, is it Lady Macbeth?
Correct. It is the very torrid Lady Macbeth. and it sounds like this.
I'd rather stop you breathing than have you doubt how I feel.
Moving on, it's Lena Dunham's latest. It's this.
It's close to my face.
You have wings. You must learn how to harness them.
You don't get to decide who we are, where we go, or how much we cost. Like, we're just things. We're not things. We're people. And we can think, and we can hear, and we can feel. But we are young.
We run. I wish I could help every girl in the world.
Knowing your own story will be your salvation.
But for now, I am enough.
So this is Catherine Called Birdie. Yes. Tell us about it, Matthew.
Yeah, so this is the new one from Lena Dunham, best known for TV series Girls. But this is a period comedy based on a book by Karen Cushman from the early 90s. It's set in the 13th century, and the main character is Lady Catherine, played by Bella Ramsey, best known for Game of Thrones, who's nicknamed Birdie. Her father, played by Andrew Scott, he's a lord, but he's in a bit of financial bother, and he feels the way to get out of this bother is to basically marry her off to a suitor, which she's not very happy about. And there's lots of unsuitable suitors, a trail of them. So it's her mission ending up with one of these, but also trying not to displease her parents as well, so they can all sort of carry on in their in the life that they're accustomed to. And it's all sort of done in a very sort of quite broad comedic fashion, quite similar to Monty Python.
Yeah.
And we've got Billy Piper plays her mum. It's like covers of some modern songs, including Billy Piper's own Honey to the Bee. And yeah. Elastica gets a cover as well. So it's kind of an irreverent period movie.
And you say period, it is also about periods, because Birdie is 14. You know, one of the reasons that she's ready to marry is that her period starts. So she's fighting with her body, as well as trying to navigate friendship with her best friend, having a huge crush on her uncle, played by Joe Alwyn, and not wanting to get into any of this marriage stuff, and about sort of self-determination and feminism and all of those things, which sounds like a lot going on. Does it work?
Yeah, I loved it. I really, really enjoyed it. At first, I thought it was going to be a bit too sort of broad and wacky. I wasn't sure if I would like her, but it won me over really quickly. I thought she was absolutely terrific. I loved Andrew Scott as well.
I loved him in this. It's like if you love, you know, Fleabag, this is him doing a sort of variation on that, but also a bit Blackadder-y, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of despicable, but he is very sort of charming and funny as well. And there's people like Paul Kaye comes into the action. Russell Brand pops in as well. Leslie Sharp as her nurse. He's probably like the most loving character in it. They have this really sweet relationship. Yeah, I just thought it was terrific. I thought it was really, really funny. It did remind me very much of Monty Python, but it kind of gets across its serious themes at the same time.
Yeah, it's like the love child of Monty Python and Booksmart.
Yeah,
I loved it as well. I thought it was incredibly smart, funny, full of heart, and like such a departure for Lena Dunham, like in terms of tone and material, but also I think in terms of accomplishment. You know, Sharp Stick I saw at Sundance and I loathed and thought was terrible. Mm. And this is her. I think it sort of reflects her own happiness in her own life at the moment. She's really happily married and living in London. And this sort of seems to be a film that represents where she is in her life right now. She's not one that's going to shy away from difficult questions about feminism, but it's also just really, really funny. Billy Piper's so funny in it, as well as this mother that's always pregnant and despairing of her husband and her daughter, you know, and the fact that she'll say make it stop when things are going wrong. And yeah, it's just really, really excellently done, such a light touch, and I think anybody can enjoy this. I say that though, Matt, we haven't heard from you.
No,
you're sitting very quietly.
I'm glad you guys have enjoyed it. And
oh, I thought, thank you.
And the thing is, I'm very, very, very aware that obviously as like a middle-aged man, it's not kind of nice to come in and say, I did like this film, well, teenage girl, wasn't for me. But I really, really quite struggled with this. Like, and I say that as someone who, I almost had the opposite experience to Matthew, where I liked it for like the first little chunk I watched. I was like, oh, this is fun. I'd previously seen a clip quite a long time ago that basically was the scene where Andrew Scott's character is, you know, being told off for spending too much money sort of early on in the film, hence why he's got to marry her off. And he has this flashback to when he had a tiger delivered, you know, and yes. I thought that was very funny. So I was like, I was very, very sort of up for it. I really like Andrew Scott. And then I sort of, I like the fact that you said that I like that it addresses periods head on. It's sort of, again, a sort of a small trend we've had this year where that's been more openly talked about in teen movies. Things like that were good. But then I just found it like, it just was one of those films that I felt like it would have worked for me on paper when I was thinking about it, but none of, for me, just maybe this as well didn't help. I watched it alone, you know, and there's all sort of things to say about the context in which you see something. Maybe it would have played differently in a cinema, or if I was watching it with sort of, you know, a group of friends or something. But none of the jokes really sort of ever flew for me, you know. It was all just, I was kind of, yeah, I can see why that, you know, I can see why that worked in the script, but just never flew for me. And I just I was quite struggling, but as it went on to sort of get through it, really, to be honest, I was struggling not to turn it off, basically.
Did you find it smug? Much. Was that the problem, that it was sort of self-satisfied?
A bit, maybe, yeah, and a bit too quirky, perhaps. And I mean, it's a bit tonally odd in a way, because there's some quite graphic birth scenes and things like that, and, you know, and some kind of dark sort of subject matter hinted
at. She gets regularly beaten by her father.
Yeah. So there's sort of, yeah, kind of a bit of domestic abuse in there. Mm. And I say this, I didn't hate it, but I didn't get on that well with it, you know. So I was surprised when I went online afterwards and saw such positive reviews for it, really, because it just didn't work for me. But, you know, I'm glad it is working for other people.
It's totally working for me.
I can see why some people won't like it. I think because it is quite broad and like wacky, like you say. I think it will be a bit divisive.
Did you stay to the end for the end?
Yes.
Credits. Yeah. Sting? That was random, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah.
I was just enjoying the music, so that's why I.
The music in it is great. I loved all the covers.
I enjoyed the music. And there were some very funny bits in it. And I did like Bella Ramsey a lot in the lead. I thought she was likable, and I liked her as a character. I just was never like hugely compelled by the film.
I think you need to try again.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. I just felt like one of those films that it just kind of just went from one bit to the next, essentially like one suitor to the next. That's what it just felt like.
Yeah, it's
like chapters of a book, you know. That's how it felt. So it's like, oh, right, on to the next one. But
I went and bought the book after I
did. You?
Yeah, because I liked it so much. I bought the book, and that's written as a diary. It's kind of, it's very sort of Adrian Mole. Esque.
Yeah, that's how it sort of starts, isn't it?
I thought Joe Alwyn was really good in this. Like, he hasn't been brilliant recently with Claire Denis film that got so much scorn at Cannes, but he's so warm and loving in this, and such a delight as a heartthrob figure for this girl. Everything about it worked for me. Top stars for you, Lena Dunham, for writing and directing this. I think she's hit every single button on this for me. I flipping loved it. So I'm just going to say you're wrong, Matt, and me and Matthew are right. If you want to see who's right and who's wrong, Catherine Colbirdi is in cinemas from Friday and then on Amazon from the 7th of October. Right, let's move on to our final film now. It's this.
When you grow up in a community where everything you know is powerful and good and it's black, there's no concept of race that defines Sidney Poitier.
I left the Bahamas with this sense of myself. And from the time I got off the boat, America began to say to me, you're not who you think you are. I'm a black
man in a white. There was a habit in Hollywood of utilizing blacks in the most disrespectful ways. And I said, I cannot play that.
I don't think Sidney ever played a subservient part. Never plucked his eyes, never ducked his head.
They call me Mr. Tibbs. I'm a black man in a
white world. So this is Sidney, about Mr. Poitier. Matt, explain how this documentary unravels.
This unravels very much as a straightforward cradle-to-grave, you know, life story, really, of the late, great Sidney Poitier. It's very slick in terms of this kind of documentary. It's got some huge stars as talking heads, including Oprah Winfrey, who's a producer as well, and Denzel Washington. Sidney Poitier himself, who obviously died this January, but beforehand must have recorded his to camera pieces. So it's really nice having him as the sort of overarching voice and narrator, almost recounting his life story. And yeah, we literally go from his childhood through his teens, then through his career, basically, as he becomes a huge Hollywood star. And then it's more mostly focused on that in that it skirts over his quieter later years a bit. Overall, it's one of those documentaries for me where some people will find it too slick and glossy. It's not completely warts and all, although it does address some kind of, you know, controversial topics, but it's very, very glossy, very celebratory. But I really enjoyed it. It was, I enjoyed kind of, you know, revisiting his films. He's obviously super charismatic. He obviously was such an important figure. I really, really enjoyed it. Found it sort of touching and enjoyed revisiting those sort of scenes and clips and getting a bit more context on it. And
did
you guys enjoy it?
I didn't really know much about him. I mean, obviously I knew about him as a actor and his contribution to cinema, but I didn't really know anything about his childhood and how he grew up so poor. And so he had never seen a mirror until he left home, and he hadn't seen a car. And this idea that he had come from an environment where racism really didn't exist for him. You know, it was a black community where that was celebrated and joyous. And then he arrives in the United States and is confronted with this era that's very conflicted and, you know, very much a sort of a race war. And he's arriving in a time in Hollywood when civil rights is swirling around him, and that he's got this pressure to represent an entire race, essentially, and that that's a huge thing for anyone to embody and take on. So I thought that was really interesting to think about him in those terms. I mean, I knew he was a trailblazer, but I hadn't really thought about, you know, what that must have been like for him, and that it was something that was perhaps put upon him more than he took on himself. So I found that really interesting. And I just loved him. Like, I haven't really seen many interviews with him, and he's just pure class, isn't he?
He's got a real twinkle, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's just so sort of charismatic and sort of elegant, isn't he? And
elegant is a perfect word to describe him. Yeah. Did you like it, Matthew?
I did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, like I was saying, it's very sort of linear and straightforward. It doesn't kind of break any boundaries as far as the filmmaking goes. It's all sort of talk clips and talking heads, but, I mean, done in such a kind of classy, enjoyable way. And you get, like, the really famous clips. Like, obviously, they call me Mr. Tibbs scene. But then it gets they properly analyse it. You know, you get Spike Lee and Denzel Washington really go over it. And there's a key bit from the Defiant ones as well. So I like that. They kind of went into detail on that, even though they do kind of, like Matt was saying, they skip over other bits of his life, like some of his later roles as well. And they address his directorial career, but not at any sort of great length.
No, it's much more centered in the comet that he was sort of landing, and the repercussions of him appearing in Hollywood as this leading man, an Oscar-winning leading man. That's really the focus of it, isn't it? And of course, the fact that Oprah is like producer, but also a talking head on this, you know, whatever she sort of talks about or gives her stamp of approval to, you know, people are very interested in. So it is interesting that she's using her platform to shine a light on his career, and especially his early career. Because there are films as well, I don't know about you guys, but there are films I realised I hadn't seen of his that I now want to watch and revisit with love and things, because I haven't seen for so long, and I don't think I appreciated what he was doing in those films.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't appreciate that he won his Oscar before the Civil Rights Act had actually come in. Because again, it's history to me. Like, I didn't realize it actually before that, like, just quite what a big deal it was, even more so than I realized. And then the fact that he did have that sort of summer of 1967 where he had to serve with love in the heat of the night and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and he was just like the biggest star, you know, of the sort of the cinema that year. Definitely makes you want to revisit some of them.
I liked all the stuff about his relationship with Harry Belafonte.
They were like rivals, frenemies.
It's kind of a shame you don't hear from him, but they do kind of go into detail on it. So yeah, that was one of the best parts of it for me as well.
Okay, so I think we're saying that this is worth a look. This is Sydney, and it's on Apple Plus from Friday.
And from that day, you owed me everything you could ever do for me, like I will owe my son if I ever have another. But you don't own me.
That's all we've got time for this week. What's your film of the week, Matthew?
Catherine Called Birdie.
Yay.
I loved Andor as well. See, it's TV, but yeah, Catherine.
Okay. Not Matt's choice, I suspect.
Andor is the must watch for me this week.
I'm a Catherine Call Birdie, but also I would suggest that people do watch Don't Worry Darling, simply because that filmmaker and that cast have had a lot of rubbish the last few weeks. So maybe you should go and see the actual thing that they've made and not just engage in the social discourse on it. Right, before we go, it's time for a listener's question, and it's suitable for this. Everyone's back to school or college now. What's the best school, college, uni film for you, Matthew?
I might be stealing Matt's thunder. Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused. But if Matt wants to have that, I'll say Clueless. But I think Dazed and Confused is the best one. But I love Clueless.
Has he stolen it?
He's stolen mine. I was going to say Dazed and Confused. Matt. But School of Rock is another very good Richard Linklater school film as well. So I'll go for that.
Cool. I'm going to go for Captain, My Captain, Dead Poets Society. Gets me every time when they stand on the desks. I love that. But also I would say Booksmart is a great school film.
Half Nelson is another very good school, very different kind of school film. That's worth seeking out if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, and if you're talking about sheer volume, probably Hogwarts and Harry Potter is a very good films, many films.
And you get like a full 7 years at school or whatever.
It's like being at school when you watch the Harry Potter films. Mm. It takes that long. Okay, so on that note, we will say goodbye. We'll be back next week with more. But for now, say goodbye, Matthew.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
And it's goodbye for me. See you next week. I close my eyes and I see you clear. It feels like you're lying here. All the things I want to say come and go. Easy as a breeze, those words just flow. I float on air like a fairy feather. Your love so sweet like an open flower. I'm dizzy from the time we spent together. I need that horny drip every hour. I'm thinking about it, your sugar lips. Got a feeling for you now that's so strong. I'm dreaming of the candy in your fingertips. Baby, don't stay away from me too long. I've been missing you, I should be kissing you. Honey, you the bee, that's you for me. I wouldn't tell a lie.